This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show. You're listening to an exclusive podcast of Finding Your Bliss with host Judy Liebrack, heard every Saturday at 1 p.m. on Zoomer Radio.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to Finding Your Bliss, the show that helps you find and follow your bliss. I'm Judy Liebrack, and as you all know, I'm very familiar with the world of infertility because my husband is Dr. Clifford Liebrack, one of the leading fertility specialists in Canada and the founder and director of the Create Fertility Center. And about a month ago, he told me about a very exciting new book called Infertility, The Story of a Miracle and the Big Business Behind It. The author, Catherine Blaise Baum, is an award-winning investigative reporter with the Globe and Mail, and is also, as it turns out, his patient. We were invited to the book launch in early April, and I was struck by the powerful words she spoke at the event, and I couldn't wait to get home and start diving into her book. Infertility is a deeply personal memoir and is also an investigative report not only into her fertility odyssey, but into the world of fertility at large. In the book, she also describes in evocative detail the emotional, physical, and financial toll of IVF, in vitro fertilization, and her own harrowing journey of trying for a second child, which resulted in multiple miscarriages, two IVF clinics, two surrogates, over 100 ultrasounds, and hundreds of injections. The book is honest, raw, authentic, and compelling account of Catherine's struggle with infertility, the story of the miracle, or should I say miracles, and twists and turns that happened along the way, and the big business behind infertility. It's a gripping, compelling page-turner, and while Catherine's always been known for her powerful storytelling as a journalist, and for bringing a thoughtful and deeply human lens to every story she tells, this one takes it to a whole new level because it's about her and her journey. It's raw, unflinching, authentic, and not only heartbreaking, but heartwarming all at the same time. The result really is a triumph. And I listened to it, as I mentioned, in the virtual green room on Audible. And I recommend that to listen as you read the book. Do them together. She's here to tell us all about infertility, the story of a miracle and the big business behind it. It's an instant bestseller. But before we meet her, let me tell you a little bit more about her. So as mentioned, the book, Infertility, chronicles Catherine's own harrowing journey with IVF and surrogacy that culminated in two siblings for her daughter, each born 4 months apart, one via surrogate and one naturally conceived, alongside an examination of the industry that explores questions of healthcare, ethics, the law, trauma, and access, and a lot more. As mentioned earlier, Catherine's been a journalist for nearly two decades, and she's probed systematic failures related to criminal justice, healthcare, immigration, labor law, food safety, and child welfare. She has covered major breaking news events in Canada and internationally, including the 2013 Boston Marathon bombing and the 2010 earthquake that rocked Haiti. Before joining the Globe and Mail, Catherine was a reporter for the National Post and a Manhattan-based stringer for the New York Times. Catherine lives in Toronto with her husband, Dan, and their three children. Catherine Blaise Baum, longest bio in the history of ever. Congratulations on all of this and welcome to Finding Your Bliss.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here.
Catherine, before we dive into your beautiful, very readable and powerful book, and I just have to say that I love that it wasn't Pollyanna. I love that it didn't sugarcoat it. It really tells the real story and the true story. And I really did appreciate that because I've read a lot of other books on infertility. And there was just something deeply personal, but at the same time, deeply scientific and so beautifully orchestrated. So really congrats on all of it.
Thank you. That was my hope. So I'm glad it came through.
It really did. I mentioned off the top that your fertility doctor was Dr. Clifford Liebrack, who I know very well. And it was very touching at the launch when you gave him a very heartfelt hug. And I can tell you that he was beaming and so happy for you. And I can tell you also that he genuinely cares about his patients and is so beyond elated when they have a positive outcome. But let's go back to the beginning, because having a second baby and beyond only really happened after 4 years of a very traumatic and at times horrifying really horrifying journey that was motivated out of your innocent desire to create a sibling for your other child, your daughter. I know that you were one of five children, had a very happy childhood, and you wanted the same for your growing family. Can you tell us more about your brainchild, and when did the idea first take hold for you? Like, when was the moment you knew this is a story that I absolutely need to tell?
Oh my goodness. There was like this one moment that I remember lying on the clinic exam table and staring up at the clinic ceiling. I don't even have to close my eyes to imagine what it looks like. As an IVF patient who's had a prolonged journey, anyone out there who has had that experience knows what it looks like and feels like to just lie there for the what feels like thousandth time for yet another transvaginal ultrasound or yet another procedure or yet another acupuncture appointment. And I remember just lying there and thinking to myself, what have we gotten ourselves into? At this point, we had done multiple retrievals, despite the fact that we had an excellent prognosis. You know, it was very clear to me that this had become a complicated road. And it's very hard for me to take off the journalist hat and see the world in any other way than as a reporter. So while I was the patient, I'm still a journalist. And so I was lying there and I just remember thinking like, man, one day I'm going to write about all this. I didn't know it was going to be a book and I didn't know it was going to have a crazy plot twist with these two babies born just 4 months apart. But here we are, and I did it. And I'm really glad that I did it because I think it's really important that we give patients an unvarnished view of what might lie ahead for them and to help measure their expectations at the outset so they can go into it with a more prepared mindset.
Did you keep notes? Did you write a journal at the time as you were going through it? Or was this all from memory? And then when you did 100 interviews, as you went through the putting together of your book, that's when you took a serious dive into getting things exactly as they were. But did you have notes or thoughts that you...
It was one of those things where, yes, I did keep a journal for parts of it. And then also, though, there was so much that was in writing. When you think about the way you communicate with friends and with family, when you're going through something really hard, it's often in writing. And for me, I guess, as a writer, that is what I leaned into. So I went through all of my text messages, all of my emails, all of my videos and photos on my phone for over 4 years, right? And so what I can tell you is that out of all of these emails, right, there were 4,000 that were directly related to the creation of a child by IVF. So that gives you a sense for what we went through. But within all of that, there was a lot of mining of my feelings and working things through. And there were a lot of sort of benchmarks along the way that I could feel and see in text messages with friends. So there was some of that. There was also some journaling, yes. And then also going through photos really gives you a good sense of where you were at emotionally.
Yes, absolutely. I love the title of the book, and I don't know if people notice it. And I remember I first sort of stumbled and I said, wait a minute. It's infertility, the story of a miracle and the big business behind it. And the way you separated the words infertility,
yes,
which to me meant suggest living in this mad world of fertility. And I love the double entendre in that title.
Yes, thank you.
Tell us more about how you arrived at that.
Well, yeah, no, you nailed it. That is the point, is when you are going through fertility. And I would say that I'm speaking for myself, but I have now spoken with a lot of patients, and I think I can speak for many of them when I say that it is an entirely consuming experience. It is the existential fight of your life for life. And so the state of being in fertility felt so, like, it really resonated with me. The other thing that I thought was interesting about the title was the way that in is sort of differentiated from the word fertility, because, and it is gray, and it's gray intentionally, because infertility is a gray zone. As you can see with even somebody like me, who for years went through treatment and was considered infertile, and then who went on to have another child naturally, unexpectedly. So it's this limbo zone, it's this uncertain realm, and at the same time, it is consuming. The way I describe it in the book is fertility and this pursuit becomes, you know, the white noise of your life. It's always there. And I would say that it's in like the background, but it is so in the foreground. It becomes the A plot of your life and the rest of it just becomes the B to Z plot. And it's right. It's so in the background, everything else.
So I know you're a very detailed person. I mean, I can just tell from your research, which is impeccable, your writing, which is exquisite, but I noticed even the colors on the cover of the book are white, gray, black and red. And at the launch, you were dressed in a gorgeous white off-the-shoulder top with black pants, your husband in gray, your daughter in a beautiful red dress, mirroring the cover of the book. And so it almost felt poetic. Was that intentional?
I mean, really, some of it is intentional, but I swear to you, my daughter picked that red dress out of all of the dresses. She went through like four websites. She wanted to be something special. So she picked a red dress. Now, did I somehow through osmosis teach her that red is an excellent color that I love clearly as I wear it today? I don't know. But I think for me also, there's something powerful about the combination of those colors for all kinds of reasons. One is, I'm a journalist at the Globe and Mail. Those are the Globe's colors. And to me, it indicates that this is a serious, reported, journalistic endeavor, that this book isn't written, like I am patient, but I am journalist. And so I thought that it was kind of a powerful combination, and so did the team at Penguin. But also there's something about those colors to me that evokes battle or war. And when I say that I felt like there was this, first of all, civil war raging within my body, parts of it telling me, please stop, you are hurting yourself. And the other part saying, no, give us another try. There's that, but there's also this like mental battle, and it is a fight. And so to me, the colors are very me, but they are very evocative. And I hope that that comes through, or that those kind of meanings and intentions
are really did. It really, really did. And one of the most striking things as well about your book, Infertility, is the structure of it. Because you really weave together a deeply personal memoir with investigative journalism. And it's not choppy. It's very effortless, grace-like. As I mentioned, you interviewed 100 people for the book. And I felt you had a real desire to really help people who are struggling with infertility by giving them a very real picture of the highs, the lows, the good, the bad, and the ugly, all of it. It also really reads like a page turner. I don't know if that was deliberate.
Thank you. That was so deliberate. I wanted it to read like a page turner, almost like a thriller, like a mystery, like what's going to happen next. I wanted the reader to be propelled page after page, because if you try to write a book about science, the law, regulations, and policy, you're going to lose people. And this book is not that. This book does weave in a lot of investigative reporting and a lot of interviews. But my hope, and bless you for saying it, is that it feels seamless and that you're reading and you're like, wait, how did we get here? How are we all of a sudden talking about an RCMP raid? Or how are we all of a sudden talking about a New York Times op-ed with one of the stars from Modern Family? And why are the Kardashians in the book all of a sudden? You know, like, I want it to be an interesting read. I don't want people to want to put it down.
I want to tell our listeners that these were interviews with patients and doctors and lawyers and surrogates and researchers and psychologists and more. And as we mentioned as well, this book begins as your personal journey to give your daughter a sibling. And it culminates in the birth of two baby boys, born 4 months apart, one via surrogacy and the other unexpectedly and miraculously conceived naturally. That actually created a gasp in me at that point when that happened.
I actually a gasp in you, imagine my gasp.
Oh my God, I can't. And to unpack it all, let's begin by just talking about surrogacy, which is a whole other kettle of fish. And I love that you dedicated the book to both of your surrogates, to Kendra and to Stacy. Surrogacy is a very complicated thing. It didn't work out with Stacy, but you formed an inexplicable bond with her nonetheless. Can you first just tell us about Stacy?
Sure. So, and thank you so much. Like, I love that you are asking about her and Kendra, because these women are absolute angels. And I joke with them that, yes, their journey is maybe over with us, but they are stuck with us forever, because like they feel like they're family now. And not every, we're called intended parents. You know, there's surrogates and the intended parents. Not every intended parent surrogate relationship is going to end up that way. And that's just what happened with us. And I'm so grateful for that. So Stacy is somebody that we met through a surrogacy agency. She had it on her heart to carry for a stranger. And she lives in Ontario, which, you know, is lovely because there's an opportunity for us to actually sort of see each other in person sometimes. But how it sort of begins is this sort of like 10-day, two-week matchmaking period, or like
right.
kind of. So our journey was during COVID. So we weren't able to meet in person, which we absolutely would have, you know, loved to do. So we met with her and her husband, Doug. My husband, Dan, and I met with her and her husband, Doug. And I thought it was really neat that Stacey wanted Doug to be really involved in sort of helping her choose the couple to go on the journey with, because she knew that it was going to be her body and it was going to be her going to the appointments, and that she was obviously going to be deeply invested in the process, but she wanted him to feel connected. And that tells you a lot about Stacey. And we just developed like a very natural, organic relationship. And something that I get asked a lot, and actually one of the first questions I had for a friend of mine who had done surrogacy prior to me, is how do you trust someone to do that for you, to carry your child, to bring your child into this world? And usually it's a stranger. How do you ever get there? And I remember my friend saying to me, you will know when you get there, and you will find someone, and you will know. And she was totally right. We connected immediately with Stacey, and we did know. It was very clear to me that she was somebody that we could trust, that we had a bond with. We knew that she would carry this child as if it were her own. And she was really like just responsive and communicative. And as an anxious fertility patient who asks a lot of questions, that's what we want. And she tolerated all of it. And that's part of the deal. So that's Stacey. And yes, she did do 4 embryo transfers with us, 4 of them. And not a single one of them resulted in even a chemical pregnancy. Not a single time did she do a pregnancy test and it come back positive. And it was unbearable for everybody, but also just baffling, because these were genetically tested embryos. So they had been deemed to be chromosomally balanced. So why were they not working when she had this proven uterus? She had given birth to 2 of her own kids and everything looked good. So like, why didn't it work? And we'll never know. We will never know.
Oh, that's so crazy. The other thing that I'd love people to know is the altruistic nature of this, because people don't realize that. They think, oh, surrogates make money. No, not in Canada. It's only expenses. And you can explain more about this. In the US, yes, they can actually make money to be a surrogate, but that's not the case in Canada. They're actually doing it for altruistic reasons, usually having to do with, it's related to our show, their sense of purpose. It gives them a sense of purpose. Can you speak to that?
Meaningful. Yeah. So like, let's zoom way out. So surrogacy in Canada, yes, it is legal, right? And actually I learned that in many countries around the world, it's not. I didn't realize that it's outlawed in much of the world. So in Canada, it is legal to have a child through surrogacy. What is not legal is to pay a surrogate for their services, or to pay someone to arrange the services of a surrogate. What is allowed under what's called the Assisted Human Reproduction Act is the reimbursement of expenses. And those expenses have to be in compliance with some guidance that was issued by the federal government belatedly much later than when the act came out. But there are some things that you are allowed to reimburse the surrogate for. So examples of that might be additional groceries due to their increased caloric intake, or maternity clothes, or some childcare if they need some assistance caring for their own children, whether that's because they are on bed rest or they need to come into the city for an appointment. The point is for the surrogate not to be out of pocket for anything. But the point is also for them not to be paid for their literal labor. And so it's a very interesting and complex discussion around this, because everybody is getting paid except the surrogate. The doctors, the lawyers drafting the contracts, the pharmaceutical companies making the drugs, the clinics, the psychologists that do the assessments, everybody. And so, you know, there are arguments on both sides and they are interesting, but Canada has taken the position that with the law, that to guard against the commodification of women's bodies and to protect against coercion for financial reasons, surrogacy in Canada must be altruistic.
Yeah. Wow. But it just says so much about the people who are doing it. And I want to fast forward now to Kendra, who was the surrogate that, of course, carried Oliver, your second child. And I love the relationship that you formed with her and the heartfelt and authentic manner in which you told the story. Kendra's very special to you and your husband, Dan, and to your whole family. Can you tell us about Kendra and what she meant to you and just sort of the beginning?
So we actually met Kendra a slightly different way than how we got in touch with Stacey. So with Kendra, we actually, Dan and I made a post on Facebook, which felt really uncomfortable for both of us because, you know,
you're private.
We're pretty private. And so we created a post and it went out on Facebook, and Kendra was just scrolling one day and she randomly came across our Facebook post and connected with it and was curious about why it was that we needed help building our family or growing our family if we already had one child. And so that kind of brought her into our story. And we connected with her, had a similarly wonderful initial conversation with her and her husband, Sebastian, and also her kids, like, jumped on frame during our video call, and they were just, like, goofy, and it just felt like, I remember touching Dan's hand and just kind of, like, grabbing it, and the implication being, like, oh my gosh, I think we found her. And so we, again, developed this easy, natural relationship in this otherwise kind of awkward circumstance of trying to get another woman pregnant. And so what was neat too was that it just so happened that Kendra and Seb lived near the highway on the way up to our cottage.
Yes.
And that was just such like a funny thing to think about, that we had driven by her house all these times. And now she was like, we would drive by from the cottage sometimes and like wave and be like, hey, hello, Ollie. Like we knew what he was going to be named. And we'd pull over and we'd run in and we'd say hi. And so we are very fortunate that both of these women were doing it for the right reasons. And we're so clear about wanting, as you said, you know, the reason for your show is bliss, is finding purpose. And I think for Kendra, for sure, that was a big part of it. She felt really purposeful in her life. She felt like she was really giving back, that she was really doing something for somebody else. And that's something that she will have that forever. Just like we will have Oliver always. She will always have this thing that she did for us.
Which is just so, so incredible. And then something miraculous happened, a twist and a turn. And as I mentioned, I gasped. I'm not even compared to your gasp. Can you tell us what happened after Kendra was already carrying Oliver? Spoiler alert, you weren't feeling well. Don't answer that just yet. We're going to go on a short commercial break and we'll be right back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And I'm here with Catherine Blazebaum, author of Infertility, the story of a miracle and the big business behind it. And just before the break, Catherine, I was asking you about, spoiler alert, you weren't feeling well.
So I wasn't feeling well. And by this point, I had 4 miscarriages and a bunch of failed embryo transfers. So we had lost hope in my body to do this. And so I remember looking at my husband, Dan, and saying, if I didn't know better, I think I was pregnant. I felt like I did when I was pregnant with Sydney. I was really tired. I was kind of like lightheaded. I felt like if I didn't eat every 10 minutes, I was like shaky and I was nauseous. And so I just was like, my head was spinning, but then I was like, hey, either that or like something's really wrong with me. Like my head went to other places because it felt much more likely that I had some other ailment than it was that I was pregnant. So I won't get into the details, but I had also had like a cervical biopsy around this time. And so I had delayed bleeding. And so I thought that I'd had my period, which is why I didn't think to do a pregnancy test at home until I was really nauseous and really unwell. And so I took a pregnancy test and very quickly there were 2 lines on this pregnancy test. And I cannot tell you the shock. I mean, you can imagine what the shock would be. So I remember I called Dan into the bathroom and I handed him the pregnancy test. And he's like, what is that? And I'm like, I know. And he's like, this is a joke. And then because I had started laughing because I was like, I guess nervous. Couldn't quite take it in psychologically. And it wasn't a joke. And it was very real. And so I went to your husband's clinic to CREATE. And I certainly didn't think that I would be there again, let alone pregnant myself. And it was such an interesting experience. I mean, I was there and I really did not know if we were going to see a heartbeat, right? Like we'd had so many losses. So we didn't really let ourselves even get excited about this pregnancy. That's what happens when you have multiple miscarriages. The positive pregnancy test doesn't really mean much anymore, as dark and as sad as that sounds. And I just remember being in the waiting room and like looking around and thinking like, I can't believe I'm here. I hope all of these women get what they are here for. And so, yeah, we did the ultrasound and there was a heartbeat and it was measuring exactly as it should. And I remember then going in to see Dr. Liebrach in his office, and he just like looks at the file and he looks up at Dan and I, and he's like, "Well, you sure went from famine to feast." And I was like, that's one way of putting it. And so he was as shocked as we were. And then there were some like very serious conversations that we had to have around whether this was going to be a viable pregnancy or a safe pregnancy, because as I describe in the book, I was at a high risk of developing a placenta condition that could put my life in danger and could put the baby's life in danger. And so that was a rude awakening to have that conversation. But fortunately, everything went as it should.
So amazing. And also you'd had falls. You were fainting in the bathroom. You had like some terror. Like I want people to read it to see what this was, the happy part of the book, but there was so much that happened up until this point. So this must have been, you must have been euphoric when you realized this was a viable, actual possibility after all that you'd been through.
It honestly didn't feel euphoric until Oliver came into this world, because as a fertility patient who had been through multiple miscarriages and who had gotten bad news over and over and over again, we did not exhale. And I would say that until he was born, but even a little bit afterward, because he was born premature and had to be in the NICU. But yeah, when Kendra gave birth, like I described in the book, that I was a shaken can of soda and she just cracked it open. My emotions just poured out of me. I actually have goosebumps and chills like thinking about that moment, in part also because Oliver, this little munchkin of mine, didn't cry right away and needed immediate interventions to breathe. But when I heard his cry, I could really release and let go. But it was wild because the first time that I held him, then I got this other baby kicking inside me because I was 25 odd weeks pregnant myself at the time. So it was very disorienting, I will say. But yeah, what we went through was entirely traumatic. And I would say that it is an outlier for its gore, but I'm not so sure that it is after doing interviews with other patients and talking to doctors. I do know that there are some patients who go from point A to point B to point C, and it's linear and they get good news at every turn. If you're listening and you are embarking on this journey, I hope with all of my hope that that is you. Unfortunately, the reality is that it usually is a twisty and turny journey. And that's the point of the book, really, truly, is I think by the time you show up at a fertility clinic, you're there for a reason. You've either been trying naturally for some amount of time that hasn't been working, so you're already heartbroken, anxious, and potentially depressed. Or you've been told at a young age that can't carry for some reason, or that you've got reproductive issues, or you're a same-sex couple, or you're doing this on your own. There's all kinds of reasons why you show up at a fertility clinic. But many people show up and hope that it will be a silver bullet, that modern science is there to do this miraculous thing for them. And in the fortunate cases, it does do that. But you can really get beaten up along the way. And if I had better measured my expectations, I think I would have had a lighter experience emotionally. Like, I want people to know that while you may be told that after an egg retrieval, you can go to work the next day, give yourself an extra day, at least planning wise, because in my experience doing it five times, no, I was in bed. And so were many of the patients that I spoke with. Or they would show up to work and they would be so uncomfortable. You can't do up your pants. You have a splitting headache. You're so bloated. You can't wear pants for much of an IVF journey, where at least you have to go up, you know, a size, or you're wearing like, you know, speaking freely here, right? And that's just the least of it. You're tired, you're hormonal, because you're actually hormonal, and you're fatigued, you have excruciating headaches in some cases. And so it can be very, very hard physically. And then it can be very, very hard emotionally. And then that can make your job, your day job, very hard. It can put a very significant strain on your relationships. And I just want people to know that that's kind of typical and it's okay. But please measure your expectations. Have hope. But I think it's one thing to expect it to work and expect it to be easy, than to hope that it works and hope that it's easy. Those are very different things.
Absolutely. It was so interesting for me to read this, Catherine, because my experience with the world of infertility is that my husband literally works, and I think you know this, because I think your first appointment with him was on a Sunday night or something.
Oh my gosh. Had some Sunday night,
right? So it's 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Like, yes. He's never had a weekend in years. And he's a pretty benevolent kind of guy. He's kind, compassionate. But I love when you write and you really describe him. Dr. Lee Brack, for his part, has a sort of mad scientist air about him. On our initial consult, I thought to myself, okay, this guy doesn't have the most traditional bedside manner, but he seems to eat, sleep, and breathe fertility. Upon meeting him in person, we found him to be present and reassuring. It felt like he would get SH done, like he would indulge our desire to try some approaches that may be more proven in randomized control trials, but had showed promise. I felt like he saw a tough case as an intellectual challenge over which he would triumph. We want to do things that are based on evidence, but we do have to think outside the box and be more creative, Dr. Liebrach told me, reflecting on our case years later. Dr. Liebrach, who's a professor, Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Toronto, fixture in the Canadian fertility community, etc. So while I've been to the clinic numerous times to wait for him, often for hours,
yeah.
I thought you did a wonderful job of really evocatively describing the baby photos on the walls with the thank you notes and the doctors in white coats running around and that flurry of activity, interaction with patients. Like, you really created, it almost could have been like a movie. Like, you could see what was happening. And I've seen it all. And reading about it from your perspective, though, gave me a whole new and much deeper understanding of what patients go through. And I really appreciated that. You had been to other clinics. You'd been through so many difficult moments, disappointments, failures. And there was a turning point that brought you to Dr. Liebrach and CREATE that you write about in the book. And what was that like when you first got there? Did you feel that sense of hope, like I'm starting anew?
Yes. And I think, again, switching clinics is a personal decision. As a patient, it's really hard to know when is the right time to move. Should you move? It's very scary because in some cases, if you already have embryos, you are literally moving your embryos. And that is terrifying, right? You're just trusting that the transport company is going to do it right. If so many things have gone wrong, if you're right out to switch clinics, things probably haven't been going smoothly. So just, it's very daunting. Like, you just worry about all the things that could go wrong and is it safer to stay put? But yeah. In our case, it felt like sort of a natural point in time to make a switch. I think we had tried a bunch of things. We were due for a change. And you don't know if that change is going to be a clinical change in terms of, is the protocol going to be different? Is the lab going to be different? Is the testing going to be different? You don't really know what necessarily is going to be different. You might have these conversations before you make a switch, but you don't really know. And for us, what was actually the most profound was just the mental component of it. The feeling like we were doing something different, the no longer walking into the same place that we walked into for a couple of years, the meeting kind of new doctors who might say things differently, and then maybe we hear it differently. And so I think for us, it was really important for our mental health, actually, to make the switch. And in the end, you know, it proved that we did come out of this successfully. But I do think it is obviously like a personal decision about how and when you do that. I've talked to lots of patients who have come to me for advice. And I'm like, I'm no doctor, but I can tell you what it was like for us.
Yeah, amazing. I have to share page 228 to the top of 229 in the book. And I love this part in the book when you knew it was time to tell your surrogate, Kendra, who was carrying your second child, Oliver, that you discovered you were also pregnant naturally with Benjamin. And you and Dan went to Peterborough to tell her in person.
I wasn't showing yet at around 10 weeks or so. But my pregnancy was progressing too. The genetic testing came back normal. We had also found out the sex. This was getting real. I was starting to feel more relaxed in my body. I was beginning to trust it. It was time to tell Kendra. We were nervous. We didn't want her to feel like she was any less special or crucial to our journey. I was fearful she would wish she hadn't done this for us, that she hadn't put her body through the needles, the headaches, the fatigue, the carpal tunnel that had developed due to the pregnancy-fueled pressure on the median nerve in her wrist. I worried she would think that what she was doing had less reason or purpose. I was worried she would think we did this on purpose. She had signed up to be pregnant for me, not with me. The science may be inconclusive about the direct impact of stress and cortisol on conception, but it was impossible for me to believe that I would have gotten pregnant, let alone stayed pregnant, without the peace and hope she had bestowed upon us. We wanted to tell her the news in person, so we drove out to Peterborough for our OB appointment and waited for the right moment. The doctor had left the room after doing her exam. Everything looked and sounded good. "We have something to tell you," I said. "It's kind of wild." "Oh my God, what is it?" she said. "Oh my God, are you pregnant?" We couldn't believe she had guessed it, just like that. She was in shock, processing the two 2023 due dates. "You're going to be super pregnant and have a newborn," she said, her head spinning. "I know," I said. "It's crazy." We hugged her tightly. We put our hands on her belly. We told her this was unexpected. We told her we hoped she knew that this didn't change how we felt about her or the pregnancy she was carrying. She was giving us the gift of two babies, two baby boys.
Wow. And that was one of the moments where I started bawling in the book. There were many.
Yeah.
Not to warn everyone, trigger warning.
I know, right?
Have a box of tissue handy when you read this. So
one thing, if I could just say, because I want to, like, we read that excerpt and I just want to make sure that we also cover off this other aspect where, you know, I mentioned in the excerpt that doctors and scientists, they don't know, right, whether cortisol and stress impact pregnancy. But I did a lot of interviews around this with doctors and specialists. And basically the line of thinking is that if stress was such a big contributing factor, and if cortisol was really a big contributing factor, then doctors would be prescribing their patients vacations and spa treatments instead of the medications that they are prescribing to them. And so one doctor that I spoke with said, unfortunately, it's not quite so simple and it's not magic like that. And that, you know, there are thousands of planes that take off every day and you only really hear about the one that crashes. And so for every case that's out there, like mine, there are many, 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 many more that don't end up this way. And right. So I never want to leave the impression that, oh, if you just relax, you'll get pregnant. Like there's right. literally nothing worse that you can say to somebody who's going through this journey.
Of course. Yes. And it's funny, I have a question about that because I was going to talk to you about that, that the well-meaning things that some people say
exactly.
that are just so insensitive and so wrong. And you really, anyone listening, have to be careful about what you say to someone who's going through infertility. And what happens when your sister told you that she was pregnant?
Yeah.
And you can be two things at once. You were happy for your sister, delighted, thrilled, and sad for yourself.
So sad for myself. Yeah.
And you have to almost like, what do? Do you just avoid baby namings and baby showers and
right.
all that sort of thing for the years that you're trying? Because it's very hard.
I think just don't feel guilty either way. Take care of yourself because this is really hard and it's really hard on the person going through it. And so if you need to put up a boundary in order to be able to persist, then yeah. please do. And, you know, there is this idea of protecting your heart. And hopefully people who love you will understand.
We'll get that. I just couldn't imagine the kaleidoscope of emotions that was flooding through you at this time. Pregnant, about to have this baby, this second baby, and then to have your own third baby. Like, how did you get through this time? You just sort of like, on,
it was,
like I tried yeah, yoga, I, meditation.
No, like, was, no, that's a good, yeah. So there was a lot of that.
Yeah.
I walked a lot to clear my head because it was head spinning and it was scary. When I was pregnant, I was still worried I was going to lose the baby. Once Oliver was born, we were in the NICU. I was worried about how my daughter, Sydney, was going to adjust to not just one baby, but two. There's a lot of fears and concerns. Am I going to handle it well? Am I going to be an unfathomably anxious mother because we went to the ends of the earth and I really badly hurt myself on a number of occasions trying to make this happen. And I knew just how hard it is to make a baby that, like, literally we are all miracles. Most days I have a moment where I see a human being and think to myself, what a miracle, because it is so wild, all of the things that have to go right for us to be made. And so that is a really lovely thing that I have gleaned through this process is this perspective that I have from this trauma that still exists in me, not so deeply beneath the surface, but I can access gratitude in a way that I'm not sure I would have been able to were it not for this relentlessly horrible journey. But yeah, no, it was really head spinning, right? My brain and my body didn't really understand what was going on. There were times when I would be holding my newborn boy and I would kind of forget that I was pregnant. There were times when I would be out with just Sid and my pregnant belly. And I would be like, oh, right, there's like another one at home. Like, because your body is like not, you're not supposed to have an infant on the outside and an infant on the inside. And so the way that my pediatrician put it at one point, and I like laughed, but she was so correct, was that I was living in two time zones concurrently. Because 4 months is like not a long time in the scheme of siblings, but from 0 to 4 months, they're different nap schedules, they're different diaper sizes, they're different bottle nipple flows, they have different needs, they're different sizes. They are kind of twins, but they're not. And yeah, just juggling my daughter's needs, my own needs, my two babies' needs, wanting to have my husband and I to have our relationship. And also these two women and their families, Kendra and Stacey, who did this for us, like also wanting them to feel part of the journey because they are part of all of it.
That's so beautiful. We're going to go on a short commercial break. We'll have more with Catherine Blaisbaum when we come back. Be right back. Back in a moment.
Finding Your Bliss is brought to you by CREATE, Canada's leading fertility center for over 25 years.
CREATE is here for anyone struggling with infertility or in need of assisted reproductive technology to have children. CREATE is about cutting-edge science from highly skilled doctors. In unprecedented times like these, CREATE is about ensuring the safety of all patients and staff. CREATE has made important changes to protect you by ensuring social distancing, wearing masks, as well as screening before entering. So what about the bundle of joy that you've been hoping would come into your family? CREATE Fertility Center is here for you. Visit createivf.com to keep up with the latest changes and learn about CREATE Fertility Center's comprehensive care for every fertility journey. Keep safe and healthy during these challenging days, remembering that life is about moments that we create together.
Hi, everyone. We're back, and this is Finding Your Bliss on Zoomer Radio, AM 740. And I'm here with Catherine Blaisbaum to talk all about her new book, Infertility, The Story of a Miracle and the Big Business Behind It. And there's so many cool things though, that came out of all of this, like the fact that you said you weren't a nervous Nelly when you had your baby boy.
I was
like,
shocked.
You were second to me, and you weren't. You were actually very chill.
Yeah.
And also, you just mentioned the word gratitude, the gratitude piece that when the whole house is a commotion and everyone's crying, you go, yeah, this is blissful. It's okay.
Isn't that wild? Yeah. I know that that sounds so cheesy to say, but when my kids are, fighting or somebody's crying or things are just like really hard for reasons of having three young kids, it might take me a deep breath, but eventually and quite quickly, I will get to a place where I'm like, I fought so hard for this. Yeah. And I am so fortunate that I made it here because there are so many people who are fighting tooth and nail to get here. I was one of them. I was one of you, if you're listening, not that long ago. And a lot of people, they don't get to the end successfully. And that is so hard to confront. And I've talked to those people and I've interviewed those people. And I get asked, what do you say to those people? It is an unfathomable thing to desire a child and to not be able to do that. And I am sorry.
There's a beautiful section in the book, and I don't know the page number, but a beautiful section in the book where you talk about the word waiting. You're waiting for the results. You're waiting for the ultrasound. You're waiting in the waiting room. You're waiting here. You're waiting there. There's so much waiting. Like at the end of your wait, thank God, you got some great results. But you're right, it doesn't happen that way for everyone.
It doesn't.
But this whole waiting, like you really describe that so well.
Thank you. People. I do think that time and the passage of time is one of the most challenging aspects of the journey. You think of your time in day one, day two of your cycle. Can I call in my day one? And then on what day am I starting my treatment? And then, oh, the transfer didn't work. So now you got to finish that cycle to get back to day one. An hour feels like a day. A day is a week is a month, and a month is a year. And the way that a journey can mess with your concept of time and your ability to be rational and your ability to be rational about time cannot be overstated. You completely lose touch with what time feels like for everybody else. And one thing that I found kind of helpful actually when I was going through it was realizing that, yes, let's say we were waiting to call in my day one to start a retrieval because we need to do another egg retrieval. That while we were waiting, like my body was still actually doing something towards the goal of the egg retrieval. It was either growing the eggs, It was ovulating the eggs that we were going to be using to get ready to grow the next batch of eggs. Or maybe a transfer didn't work, right? So then we're waiting to call in our day one so that we can begin the medications to start the next transfer cycle.
Right.
You're in motion. Like you are shedding the lining and you are preparing the uterus to receive those medications and to start again. And for some reason, that was helpful to me. The other thing that I did, which like, I don't know if I should share this, but I had to reframe going to the clinic. I couldn't think of it as going to the fertility clinic. It was two nails on a chalkboard. If I had to go in there one more time, so I had to almost just take the emotions out of it and tell myself I was going to a dentist appointment.
Yeah.
Remove some of the emotion around it.
Wow.
Because like I said, it is so consuming. And so I needed to find a way to stay on the ride, but take my emotions off of it. I was going to continue on this journey towards making a baby, but I was getting off of the roller coaster.
Wow.
It took a lot of effort and a lot of time, but it takes a lot of effort to get to that place.
And a lot of self-help. Like, I even wondered when you were going through years of miscarriage after miscarriage after miscarriage, all of these falls on the bathroom floor where you're like, you would be dizzy and you would fall and you would be bleeding on the floor. And
ended up in the ER needing 11 stitches in my face, you know.
And needing 11 stitches in my face. And I wondered what got you through those times. And I know it's, you have a beautiful marriage and a wonderful family and friends and all the rest, but you personally had to do something or say something to yourself to keep going. What was it?
I think it was this idea that it's a quote. Well, it's sort of like a thought from a book that I read called Man's Search for Meaning by Viktor Frankl. And I read it at like, I guess, maybe the perfect point in my journey where I was, I think, I don't know how to go on. I don't know if I can go on, but I know that I want to, but I don't know if I can, but I want to, but I don't know if I can, but I want to. And so the point was basically that circumstances beyond your control can take away everything from you in life, except your ability to control your emotions and your response to it. So there's this idea that there's like a stimulus and a response, and that your power lies in that space between. And so I know that for some people that might not resonate, but for me it was, okay, wow, everything is so out of your control on a fertility journey. You might have a good prognosis as I did, and you might have a lot of eggs retrieved as I did, and you might end up with a lot of embryos as I did, but they might not all be genetically balanced and they might not all result in a successful implantation. So much is outside of your control. Will your lining thicken? Will you respond to medications? Will COVID happen and all of a sudden all the clinics are closed?
Yes.
Will your embryo survive the thaw before a transfer? And so to me, it was like, reclaiming an aspect of control was so important to me at that juncture in my journey. And it is what I held on to because bad news kept coming. And I would center myself on this, okay, that was out of my control. What it is in my control is how I'm going to respond.
Brilliant. You know what's so fascinating to me, I have to tell you this, is another favorite interview of mine was, and recently was Jill Deegan, the CBC's Jill Deegan. I don't know if you remember the program Here and Now. You're young, so
yeah.
I don't.
No, yeah. Of course I remember Jill Deegan.
She's so lovely. And it was a lovely interview as well. And she quoted also Viktor Frankl.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. The only other person out of 650 interviews that I've done that ever said that. So it's interesting. There's a synergy there. Now that you've been through all of this and you've come out the other side, as it were, what is the greatest thing you want to say to women who are struggling with infertility when they're really in the depths of despair and they don't know how to go on? What words of wisdom would you like to share with them?
I honestly take this question so seriously because, as you said before, you can say the wrong thing so easily. Well-intentioned people, myself included, will say the wrong thing to people who are going through it because what you need to hear is so individual. What I think is probably helpful to hear and helpful in terms of getting through a fertility journey are a few things. One is please measure your expectations because that will help you protect your heart. Please listen to your body. You are your best advocate. And women's suffering is taken for granted and diminished all of the time. But stand up for yourself. If something doesn't feel right, say something. Please ask questions because you are probably feeling quite desperate and willing to do whatever it takes. And if you have the money to do so, you will do it. And please ask questions, because there are certain things that are more and less proven in science. And I would also say, please have hope. Please let yourself be hopeful. It is very important to getting through a fertility journey. And lastly, I think I told myself this, it's going to be okay. And I know that that's easier for me to say because I had one child and I already was a mother. And that is something that I explore in the book. But I still had to make peace with not necessarily having the future that I envisioned. And it was really helpful for me to remind myself that I was going to be okay, that it was going to be okay. And there's a reason why the epilogue is entitled There Is Mercy. And it's because, to me, there is mercy in knowing that this journey will end one way or another, that you will not always be in the state of uncertainty, of yearning, of not knowing. And to me, that was among the most punishing aspects.
I love that you said the hope too, like the realism and the hope and all of it. In the book, Catherine, you talk about IVF rates, what the cost of a single IVF cycle is. Like it really also does delve into the big business of infertility, and it's amazing. And it's funny because I spoke to my husband about this and about the whole thing about measuring patients' expectations at the outset as it relates to outcomes and the physical toll, which I know you certainly look at. Important to be optimistic, but also realistic. Do you think you were given realistic expectations? And how could the industry better prepare you or people like you that are going through what you went through for the journey that lies ahead?
Yeah, I mean, obviously there is some amount of individual responsibility here. Like the patient should know and have a sense for IVF success rates, right? I'm sure that somebody told me, and I'm sure I read online, that IVF typically doesn't work the first time. But patients like really need to hear that, really take that in, that it usually doesn't work the first time, even under the best of circumstances. And so that's one thing, is just really communicating that reality.
What are the questions around access to treatment and what can we do better in Canada?
I'm so glad you're bringing up access, because I am privileged that I went through 5 egg retrievals and 8 embryo transfers and multiple uterine surgeries and was able to do this for many years. It is a privilege that I was able to do that, my husband and I. And for too many people, IVF is just not on the table, right? It is $15,000 to $20,000 for one round. And as I just said, it usually doesn't work the first time. So you are quickly getting into multiples of that. And yes, there are some provincial funding programs. For example, in Ontario, you can put yourself on a wait list if you are eligible and usually under the age of 43 and put yourself on the list for a funded cycle. However, that doesn't include the cost of medications, which is several thousands of dollars. It doesn't include the cost of embryo storage, which is a few hundred dollars a year. And it doesn't include any of the add-on treatments that may be, in some cases, indicated for a particular patient. So we have a very long way to go. There are some provinces and territories that don't offer anything. And there is no province or territory in this country that fully covers the cost of IVF. So that is the financial side of things. On sort of the geographic side of things, right? We are a very expansive country that in some areas we are sparsely populated. And so there are some provinces and territories that have not a single IVF clinic. You may have to get on a plane or drive very long distances to access treatment. And another thing that has been coming up so much at the events that I've been going to is this question of like not being able to like talk about it. In certain like cultures or communities, you don't talk about this. And so it's not something that people can explore in a way that feels safe. And that's also part of the reason why I wanted to write the book, is let this be a place where people who don't have a safe space to explore their questions, explore their questions.
That's something that I think came up at Canadian Fertility Awareness Week last week. And this is something that's so important, keeping things a secret and how important it is to be open. And you're right, your book provides a safe place for people to start doing that, which is so great. So if you know anybody going through infertility and suffering, you should be getting 2 books, one for you to read to understand more and one to give to them as well. You were also so hard on yourself, Catherine, such a perfectionist. And even though you seem to be a very resilient and a very optimistic, hopeful kind of person, you really drove yourself relentlessly in this pursuit of motherhood. Can you speak to the themes of the IVF warrior motherhood martyrdom syndrome?
Totally. I mean, I think that is I mean, I tried to explore it kind of as a journalist as well when I was writing the book, because what is it that drives us to, or some of us, because some people don't have that desire to have children, but what is it that drives the desire amongst us who do want children to create life this way? And I found that it was actually kind of like an open question, it seemed. It seems to be some combination of primal, biological, hormonal, like your brain, your organs are kind of built to play this orchestra and create this life.
Yes.
But there's also the social pressures, right? Of two under two. And if you've gotten married, well, are you going to pop out a baby soon? Or are you trying? And then there's the personality aspect of I'm determined, or in every other realm of life, if I just work hard enough, I can usually get right. what I want or right. go where I'm going, right? And make it happen. And fertility just strips you of that control. And so it is very humbling. And so you do end up, I think, at some points having to sort of question why it is that you're doing what you're doing. And for me, it really did come back to my childhood and my upbringing and my siblings. I grew up as one of five kids, and my house was full of love and laughter and chaos and children crying and fighting and competing and, you know, for everybody's attention and toys or whatever it was. And I wanted that from Sydney. So,
how is she doing as a big sister? Does she love it?
She loves it. Okay. You know what? I am not kidding. This girl has asked me for more siblings. Okay. She, and I said, why? And then it's so cute hearing her talk about it. But it's also like, at one point, she said to me, well, it's easy.
Yeah.
And I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, no, it is so, it's so hard. She, at some point, she will know the full depths of what we went through. But it is obviously very heartening to know that she has taken to this role as a big sister and that she loves it and that she's happy in her own way, tells us that she's happy that we did this.
I love that.
Thank you for asking about her.
Without giving away the ending, which really made me cry, oh my God. Especially how you tied it all up at the end and ricocheted back to some advice that you were given very early on in the journey. When I read the ending, it really made me weep, like a full-on...
Oh, wow.
Yeah, like I just love that ending. And again, and as I said this off the top, what I loved about your book the most is that it's not Pollyanna, it's not sugar-coated, and yet it's still hopeful and beautiful. It's two things at once. It's real, you hear it all, but it's still hopeful and beautiful. What is the greatest golden nugget you'd like people to get out of your book, Infertility, The Story of a Miracle, and the Big Business Behind It?
I think it is that they have an unvarnished sense for what it can be like. And that I don't want to say if you just try hard enough, you'll get there too, or just hold out for your miracle, because we don't know where all of this is headed. But what I will say, if you are somebody who's reading this and you're going through it, is that I am lending you my hope and I'm thinking of you and I hope that you get what you want.
That's so lovely. There's a question we ask everyone at the end of the show, and of course, we're going to ask it to you. What is bliss for Catherine Blaisbaum?
Bliss is my three kids screaming, crying, and wrestling, and not getting along, and then making up. No, I mean, bliss, not to harken back to our early part of our discussion, but bliss is my dreams coming to life in 3D. And it's my kids, it's my family, it's my husband. And it is also just getting to live and to not strive. So that is what's bringing me bliss these days. And I will say that, I don't know if your listeners know that you do this breathing exercise at the beginning, but can we took a moment, we took a breath before we started this conversation. And that was really grounding for me. And I do find that is a place of bliss for me, is just being present and not looking at the future and yearning for something that I felt was slipping further and further away from me. So bliss to me is, being present.
Lovely. Well, I have to tell you, this has been blissful for me. And I want to thank you very much for joining us. It's really been an honor to have you on the program.
Thank you so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
What is the best way for people to contact you, connect with you, and of course, to get a copy of your beautiful book, Infertility, The Story of a Miracle and the big business behind it.
Well, I am on Instagram as all young, I'm going to call myself young here, as all young people are these days.
Oh,
not young. I'm doing my best, okay? I'm doing my best out here.
You're doing great.
Thank you. So I'm on Instagram and my handle is at kblazebaum. So that's KBLAZEBAUM. And I would love to hear from you.
That's so great. Thank you again. Each week we spotlight a fabulous person like Catherine Blazebaum who's living their bliss. So if you're an author, artist, yoga, meditation, or mindfulness expert, or really anyone who has found and is following their bliss, we'd love to hear from you. And of course, you can always follow us, Bliss Minute, on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook. I would love to thank our wonderful guest, Catherine Blazebaum, for being on the show today. Also, thank you to Mag Ruffman, Siobhan Kylie, producer Lori Quinn, Olivia Vigiani, audio engineer Juliana Yannuziello, senior editor Lauren Kaminsky, video editor Sierra Brown Rodriguez, audio producer Faz Kazi, and everyone here at Zoomer. And of course, a big thank you to our sponsor, the Create Fertility Center. And as well, thank you to Garrett Flores for the beautiful pink roses that adorn our set each week. For everyone here, I'm Judy Liebrack, reminding you all to take one step closer to finding your bliss.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.